what makes life worth living. There's a lot of people who don't want anyone to do anything for them except for bring them groceries once a week. You know, often that comes with vascular dementia, where they it's Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. Because of the small strokes, they think they're okay, but they don't recognize that they're forgetting things, they're not taking their medications, they're not taking the, they're not getting to their appointments, you know, things are, they're not paying their bills.
As our parents grow older, it can be difficult to guide them through their golden years while still respecting their autonomy and fitting it into our already complex lives. Welcome to the Parent Projects Podcast, where our guests share practical wisdom to tackle the issues that impact adult children of aging parents. I'm Tony Sievers. Thanks for joining us today. Welcome to this week's show. If you and your family are working through dementia, early stages of dementia, working our way through family caretaking of dementia as it sits, if you are one of those members that has a generally messy situation, you've been asking for help, you're in luck. Dr. Liz Landsberg is with us today. We're going to go through assessments. We're going to go through plans of actions. We're going to go through interventions. We've got a great opportunity to help you and your family find some joy and live in the moment with dementia. Stand to. Hey, you guys have asked for a little bit of help in the messy stuff, and we, I think, are going to deliver today. Dr. Liz is a fantastic expert when it comes down to sorting through everything from the wealth of information that comes at us, what's snake oil, what might be real, the order in which that we're tackling some of the problems, some of the past historical challenges that people have. But better than that, got a great way to pull you out of that guilt and that fear and to tackle some of this with a bit of love and laughter. Dr. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited about your project, and I can't wait to let people know that there is more help for them out there. But I'm also very happy to be here and share what I've been up to working with folks with dementia and making, you know, the things that can seem overwhelming and horrible kind of manageable, and then allow the elder to enjoy their life as well as the family to have part of their life back.
Yeah. What is it that you've dedicated an entire career into this? Is that something you started out to do at that front end, or did one experience kind of lead to the other in your own kind of assessment of what was going on? Could I ask that?
So I started out as an internist, and then I went back and did a fellowship in geriatrics. And about that time, my mom was in her 60s and developed frontal dementia. And the doctors really didn't quite know what was going on. And part of her agitation was because she had horrible pain. And from the training I had for my fellowship, I helped figure out what to do about her behavior and her pain. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Now, that is so what I love into that is one of the things that what our personal experiences tend to move a lot of us that are in here in the past, especially those that want to help others do better. So thanks very much for stepping into that breach and joining us. I think one of the first things I really want to kick off with, we've had some great conversations offline and before even sitting down to do the show, talking about how do you assess the situation that's in front of you? When the family, maybe they've already done the first doctor's visit that's come back and said, not quite yet, maybe some early stages of stuff, but the family's still struggling to figure out what's going on. They're looking at a lot of commercials online. They're seeing a lot of advertisements thrown at them in Facebook and Instagram and in whatever else they're sitting there. Bottom line of when you're assessing the situation, is there a common path that a family can kind of expect that the disease would unfold, dementias maybe in general, or something along the line, or are there kind of waypoints that they could expect to start learning around or organizing themselves and assessing their own situation?
You know, so often people say, oh, I wish we would have found you 2 years earlier. So it can take several years before you get a diagnosis. Unfortunately, dementia is not well taught in medical schools. Mainly doctors know that you should do a mini mental status exam where you do, you know, 30-point questions, you know, what's the day, what's the date, where are you located? They ask you to remember three words, spell world backwards, draw a design. But you can get a perfect score and still have changes in your brain, changes in your judgment, where you can't take care of your finances. You know, maybe your memory's okay, but you've become paranoid, or you've become delusional, or your judgment is off. One woman was living on her own, you know, didn't want any help, but she was going out at 11 o'clock, and she's like 85 years old, going out at 11 o'clock at night looking for people to help her in the house. That's not good judgment. Even if her mother was 28, and they say the cutoff is 24, you know, she's not safe. So I think if you're looking at situations that are not safe, from driving to financial to behavior, that's when you definitely need to start, you know, ramping it up. And even if the doctor says, oh, they're just fine, or they're just old, you know, you need to have a better diagnosis. And locally, if you can find a medical school with a geriatric division, that's a good start. Calling the Alzheimer's Association is a good start. We're doing telehealth on Dr. Liz Geriatrics. So there's a number of different resources out there.
Yeah, that's great. And again, I think it's fully appropriately for you to pitch the Dr. Liz Geriatrics and those tools that you put up. Ladies and gentlemen, this is somebody to go to for the messy stuff. So if you're running into that, if you've had those difficult things, this is somebody that you want to talk to for those. You know, how about weighing in, because our audience and our members, they're the family members, the adult children. What should we be weighing in when we're figuring our own, assessing our own capabilities to deal with the situation, or when it needs to be somebody that understands things maybe easier than us, or maybe I live across the country. Do you got to be close by to understand this, or does somebody have to be there? Or are there any tools you can really think about that, or considerations?
Right. So the first, there's two or three big issues. The first one is, for this elder, what makes life worth living? There's a lot of people who don't want anyone to do anything for them except for bring them groceries once a week. You know, often that comes with vascular dementia, where it's Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. Because of the small strokes, they think they're okay, but they don't recognize that they're forgetting things. They're not taking their medications. They're not taking they're not getting to their appointments. You know, they're not paying their bills.
Interestingly, they're not connecting the dots on that either.
No. Yeah, okay. But in the moment, they're like, I'm fine. Yeah. Leave me alone.
Sure.
There's also sometimes people get really, COVID. Oh my goodness. So I've seen a lot of older people, the long COVID is really bad news. It's inflammation of the brain. It's not like just having a head cold. It's inflammation of the brain. So it can make it so you're fuzzy, you have trouble focusing and taking care of things. I think it's when you notice someone is having difficulty doing their daily tasks that, you know, we need to step in and figure out for them what makes life worth living. If they really want to be independent, well, can we, you know, if there is, often there's one adult child that lives close and then everyone else is somewhere else, it's not okay to leave Susie to take, you know, spend 5 or 8 years taking care of her mother. So everyone has to come together and figure out, how are we going to do this? The next thing to know about is, how much money does the elder have for their care? That's going to, you know, determine whether you can have someone come into the house, or whether they're going to have to go to a facility, or whether the family's just going to have to come together. I have a whole chapter about those sorts of things.
Well, and understanding as well, then you could also start turning, there's a whole nother learning lesson to the nonprofit world, or to the other, you know, foundations receiving your living, or others that might, or government grants or things that might be able to step up, but that can be a whole dementia. It'd be a whole group of things to learn about the good apps. It becomes overwhelming, I think, in its own right.
Well, so, actually, I think that brings up a very good point. I mean, early on, I was just talking about kind of overall planning for the family, but then there's the second layer. There's the day programs. There's the aging divisions, where they have social workers and maybe a day program. There are, there's a number of resources in the community that you guys are really good about helping, you know, coordinate families to. And I think that is important. I think there are people in the community that can help you sort through all of this stuff.
Yeah. Without a doubt. I think the important part to come through is, ensuring that you're taking that time to make an honest assessment of both, you know, where your family members at, ensuring you've got that you're starting to assemble that team around you, whether it be doctors, professionals, your own emotional support team. If you find yourself as that family member that is the only one that's in state or in town, that is finding that ways to be able to communicate the challenges and just recognize those challenges would happen. If your plan is that you're going to stand in that gap for 8 years, it's probably not going to be the strongest plan, and it could leave some holes there.
So no, starting to set those things up. That's dangerous to the caregiver. You're right. Studies show that caregivers, particularly for folks with dementia, are much more likely to have serious medical issues and die sooner themselves. So I think it's got to be made clear up front that the elders' assets need to be used for their care. It's not that Susie's going to do it for free for 5 years and give up her year, her life, and then they're still going to divide, you know, the estate, you know, the way they would have if Susie done nothing. Money needs to be used for caregivers. One person cannot take care of someone else by themselves nonstop, you know, for a long time. So I think that that would be the way I would start to approach it and have an honest conversation.
And that's great. And those may be, you know, if you're having that difficult time having those honest conversations, I know we've got some other resources out there about figuring out what you do have to deal with and what you don't have to deal with in family and the barriers. Obviously, there's a lot of challenges that come within that. But boy, Dr. Liz, I think you really point out, though, that you deliberately, if all the family can understand from that get-go that there's going to be those resources are going to need to be leveraged to take care of the parents. And you can't pin that on one family member to try to step in and just pour everything off of that. They will. I see more often than not, they will. They'll focus into that because they'll do what has to be done. But that would be one of the first places that family could start and pull something together collectively. Well, one thing I want to take a break, if we could, and this is a fantastic time to take a knee, I think, and see the project that you've been working on. Love to highlight it and see the latest book project and how other people can reach out to you and get some custom one-on-one advice for them, particularly if they've got that messy situation. So let's stand by to that.
This is Dr. Liz Geriatrics.
Hello, I'm Dr. Liz, house calls geriatrician in the San Francisco Bay Area. In my 18-year practice, I have seen it all. The complications of pain, agitation, elders being swindled, too many doctors, too many medications. Now we're taking that information and distilling it down into simple, easy to understand training modules that families can use to learn about what's going on with their loved one and what they need to do to help them and to care for them. Please see us at drlizgeriatrics.com. I look forward to hearing from you.
If you enjoyed this video, we'd love you to watch the next one.
And so the next step seems to be pretty relevant here. If you're a family that is struggling or working through the dementia aspect, we've got Dr. Liz with us today. We're working through that, helping families. We started with assessment. That next step, kind of naturally, that we'd point to in parent projects is the plan of action, setting up a solid plan of action, one that leaves room for change, knowing that like a pebble in the pond, when that first rock hits and ripples start, everything really changes. But Dr. Liz, can you talk with us about some of those aspects when we're planning how we're going to do that? So the family's understood. We think we understand what we're doing. We've got the team that's helping to assess. We've agreed as a family that we're going to use mom or dad's resources to help mom or dad the way that mom or dad would wish to be helped. And different family members might point in, one maybe more than others. But now as we're doing that plan of action, can we talk through things like the order to start tackling stuff or keeping people safe financially, physically, while we're working through those issues, addiction and those types of things? Where do we start with a plan of action?
So I always start with, for the elder, what makes life worth living? What do they want to do? I mean, someone who's never been a joiner, you know, you're not going to get them out to a day program versus someone who's been very social and still really enjoys people. you know, to have them at home with a one-on-one caregiver who may not, you know, be engaging is just awful, yeah. as opposed to going to a day program where they're going to see the guys and they're going to play Mahjong and, you know, and tell their stories that they've told 300 times before. So for the elder, you know, what's important to them? The other is, you know, what medical problems do you have? What do you have to deal with? You know, do you need, you know, supervision of the diabetes? Are they having trouble with emphysema and heart failure? And do you need, you know, some more skills? I also, a huge one is their behavior, you know. Mm. So are they behaved well enough to go to church, to go to the day program? That's often where we come in, because I am heartbroken when I hear, you know, I had another doctor say, oh, well, my grandma's just, you know, mean, and, you know, and so there's nothing we can do about that. So we're just not having anything to do with her, you know, because she's mad at us. Well, that the changes in the frontal lobe with dementia can make people more angry than they used to be, and that can be medicated. So when I hear that, you know, we're just not going to, we just don't talk to her, or we just don't take her anywhere because she's so mean, you know, it's sad, because those people can still engage, but you have to take care of it. So those are the,
and almost, in almost becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy of decline. If you start thinking through that, right?
Right. Yeah. Because if you leave someone to just sit in a chair and watch TV, their legs are going to get weaker. They're going to get contracted. They're going to get pressure ulcers, and they're going to decline a lot faster.
And there you go. Yeah.
Yep. So those are the things I think about. You know, what are the resources in your community? Hmm. I'm really excited. I'm also on the board for the Connected Horse, which is something that can be in rural areas. You can look it up online, connectedhorse.org, where it's at a barn where they've had training, and they have the caregivers and the person with dementia spend an afternoon there, and they don't ride horses, but they groom horses. They talk about horses, and they're engaged, and they're together, and it's a group of people socializing, and you break the dyad of, you know, one person telling the other one, don't do that, don't touch that. You know, there's enough people to watch them, so they're going to be okay, and you have fellowship, and it's really quite powerful. So those are the sorts of things, finding whatever, you know, staying engaged with your church, you know, the garden club. If going to the restaurant is too overstimulating and it gets people agitated, have a picnic out at the local park. You know, I think it's really engaging where they want to be, and then looking at the problem. So I often see that, once you do get a diagnosis or something like, often before you get the diagnosis, that's when people are most at risk for financial elder abuse. And I find, particularly out here where every little house is worth $1 million, you know, there's everyone from your grandson and your nephew, Jimmy, to the neighbor, to sometimes it's the lawyer that kind of steers people and can take control of them, or it, you know, sometimes it's faith leader. And there are things to do, you know, if even charities, I mean, charities are not, you know, by nature predatory, but they sell the list of people who donate. And if someone feels like, oh, I've got to give $100 to everyone who asked me for money, and they sell that list, and then that becomes, you know, 30 or 40 requests a month, and they don't have the money for that, that's predatory. And so, you know, understanding, getting a diagnosis, setting up a structure to protect the elder, and then sometimes you need to get them conserved to protect them from that sort of thing. And then making sure that you're supporting them to enjoy their days the way they want to. I mean, that is job one for the family, is keep people engaged, but also having time for the family away. You know, you can get really burned out. You can start to hate the way they breathe, you know, and find that you're, you know, at that point, you need a big step back. You probably need at least 2 weeks off, you know, and it's probably really good to have other members of the family come in and stay with mom for 2 weeks while you're gone, so they can see what actually is going on, so they can, you know, stop being so critical of you.
And there are great resources for that. A respite, is what we hear along those for those members or those that are watching. And actually, I know AARP has great resources to connect into grants, and there are whole resources that will push in to provide respite for family caretakers that are there. That's a thing. So if you are a family caretaker, if you're not tracking what that is, make sure you look at that, go find that out, plan that into what your plan of action is. Essentially what I'm hearing there is you have to plan that for that long haul. You can't just look to burn. You're going to push everything in, or you're going to cross the finish line and you're going to be just as spent.
Right. You can't say, I'm going to do this all myself. Yeah. I often hear from spouses, it's like, I have to take care of my wife. And I can tell you about, a tragedy from someone who had that idea, and it just cost him his life, and his wife just did not do well from it. The other thing that is really important is you've got to look out for the medications that cause problems. So often, if someone's not sleeping or they're a little anxious, the doctor will give them Ativan or Xanax. That is really bad news. Or, as my dad was taking Tylenol PM, even over-the-counter medicine. The Benadryl is anticholinergic, and nerve cells talk to each other with choline. And if you give something anticholinergic, the nerve cells don't talk to each other well, and people can get more confused and agitated. So I've seen, time after time that just getting something from over-the-counter or over-the-counter sleep aids, Unisom or allergy pills, Zyrtec, not good. Or prescription medications like a common seizure medication, Keppra, can make people more angry and paranoid. And it is often that the medications or the disease has caused bad behavior that makes it really difficult for the family. And if the medications were fixed, the elder would be fine. And I've seen situations where, it's obvious dementia, it's obvious, problems with the medications, but then they've hit someone and then they're charged. And then, there's a court case.
And it snowballs from there. And therein, I think what I'd really like to talk into when we come back from this next break is those interventions that come through. There has been a lot since the original publishing of the 36-hour day. There is, which is an empowering. I think it's one of the first books that most of the time gets handed to a family or gets referred to a family. It opens the eyes. It kind of helps to build empathy to understand what might be happening. And there's some great conviction to that. But we just are learning a lot, and we are learning it in a hurry over the course of the last, especially decade. And then when you pitch in COVID to watch how something like that interacted, it seemed to accelerate some knowledge about other things. It was enough medical issues and things bouncing around that we've learned a lot too. So when we look at the connectedness of interventions, not just prescription medications, but over-the-counter medications, activities that we might be doing, the combinations of those things to sort out what might be driving the activity we're seeing or the behavior that we're seeing, the truth may be that there's a dementia there, but that doesn't necessarily make it true that everything that we're seeing in behavior comes from dementia. And therein becomes a very complicated thing for the specialist to do, let alone a family caregiver. So I think when we come back from this, I'd really love to talk with you on those interventions that we're sorting that out, maybe the connectedness of that, if we could.
Sounds great.
Brilliant. So we'll stand by and get this from our sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Tony at the Parent Projects Podcast. And if you are powered by coffee the way that I'm powered by coffee, I think you'll appreciate knowing a way that you can help the last, lost, and least of us that didn't have a great transition. You see, the Refuge Coffee Company is a social enterprise operated by Catholic Charities of Central and Northern Arizona, where they use this coffee and this business model to help homeless veterans at the Manor House Transitional Community get back on their feet. Help a veteran turn a handout into a hand up by giving them the opportunity to earn your business. Purchase coffee today at therefugeaz.com. That's therefugeaz.com. If you order 6 or more bags, shipping will be free. And if you tell them that Parent Project sent you, I'm going to send you a travel coffee mug. Thank you again, and let's get back to the show.
We've got Dr. Liz Geriatrics, that is working and helping us really wrap our arms around the complexities of family caretaking in dementia. Dr. Liz, again, thanks for joining us this week and talking with us about it. But before we went out to break, we started moving through, you know, we've talked about assessments of the situation of those people that are around, what we're getting in the situation, even ourselves, our plan of actions, how to take those things into account. Interventions, we started leading into how these medications are different over-the-counter stuff that we just don't even, maybe we never gave a second thought to, and it's something that they've used for years, might be driving some of the activities that are hiding, getting an honest assessment of the situation for crying out loud, or impacting the effectiveness of this plan of action that seems to be right in line with what mom really wanted. Prescription meds, over-the-counter medications, the activities that can go. Where do we start there? What do we know now? We've learned so much. What are those golden nuggets?
Well, I would think the number one thing is do not use sleeping pills or sedatives long-term. I mean, if you must have a procedure, you know, like if you have a bad gallbladder and you need surgery and mom's really nervous and kind of wound up in the hospital, you can give Ativan for a few days. But I often see Ativan, lorazepam, Xanax, alprazolam, just given out like chiclets. And I would say that is the number one mistake that doctors make, hands down.
Okay.
And the problem is that people can get easily addicted to it, particularly with dementia. And they say give it, you know, three times a day as needed. And you might start giving out, you know, once or twice a week. But then people with particularly older people and people with dementia, or if they're not sleeping, it can withdraw and they can get more irritable. So they give more, you know, and then they give it, you know, more regularly than they give one every day. And then they start withdrawing from that. So they give, you know, it twice a day and then they up the dose. And sometimes I've seen people, you know, to me, a half a milligram once a day is a good sized dose. I've seen people on 2 milligrams a day, 8 milligrams a day. It just, it snowballs and it doesn't get better. And then you've got a complete mess. And then if you just stop it, then they go into complete delirium. There's a lot of other medications. It's on my website, drlizgeriatrics.com, and in the book, Living in the Moment, Overcoming Challenges and Finding Moments of Joy in Alzheimer's and Other Dementias. I think that if we taught geriatrics and which medications cause more problems more widely, I think, you know, 60% of my business would evaporate, which would be fine, you know, because it breaks my heart that these elders are, you know, deemed to be, you know, not appropriate for my program. Or, you know, if anyone's been delirious, you know, no one wants them in the nursing home. No one wants them in assisted living. No one wants them in their day program. What are you supposed to do? And it is so treatable, and it's not an occasional thing. And it's not that mom's just, you know, angry and she's just always been angry, so we're just going to stay away from her. You know, I can tell you family after family where you get the meds right and they're nicer and they're like, mom hasn't been like this in 20 years. So, you know, and then you can bring them back in the family. You can bring them to church. You can bring them to, you know, gatherings. And that's huge. I mean, that is the quality of life. And that is what I want to, you know, communicate. Can I give that example of that couple?
Yeah, let's talk about the couple in the fire. And yeah, I really would.
So this is kind of tragedy. Like when you don't identify early cognitive decline. And then I want to talk about the bits where we could have done things differently and how things can be better. You know, when it seems like there's nothing to be done. So this is a couple, you know, that had been married for 30 years. The man was legally blind for 20 years, felt like he really needed to take care of his wife. His wife was in her 60s. She was drinking alcohol and had cognitive decline. And she got admitted to the hospital because she had behavioral problems and they kept her there for a while. And he kept saying, nope, it's my job as her husband to take care of her, although he really couldn't. And his medical problems got worse. And then more recently, he got very weak and I think passed out. She was very angry at him. She was back drinking alcohol and a fire broke out in the kitchen. And the family member had to come rescue them. He ended up in a coma and then died in the ICU, you know, a couple weeks later, and she got placed. The rest of the story is, you know, and it was interpreted as a murder-suicide. It's like, no, not at all. And the family member was telling us that they've been trying for 2 years to get help, but the husband would never allow them to take her away. He was saying, it's my job to take care of her. Even though what I think should have happened was that the husband should have had cognitive evaluation, probably neuropsych testing, because even if his memory was okay, his risk assessment, his judgment, his what we call executive functioning, his frontal lobe functioning was not good. And if you had in place that he didn't have capacity, but you want to honor his wishes, well, you start out with, you have someone take care of the finances, and then you put a caregiver in the house to see if you can support both of them and manage her from being angry and keeping her from drinking.
You know, how often is that it's not, it gets presented that it's an either or, and fear and guilt get us to think that that's where it may be. And perhaps that's where he was thinking that it was either I'm doing it or it's not happening or working to that. So often in my life, I've just learned it's both and. It's almost always both and.
Right.
And that there would be that solution to come in when it works through. And I think I remember that he was blind, or he was legally blind as well.
20 years, he functionally couldn't do everything that needed to be done. They could have had someone assist them and someone to manage her so she wasn't drinking or she wasn't abusive to him. The way it ended up is when he died, she got discharged to a dementia community who can handle. I mean, she does get pretty irritable and agitated. The medications have been adjusted, and so she is no longer so aggressive. She's loving the programming. You know, like the first day she was there, they had a Crosby, Stills, and Nash cover band, and she was singing along with them. And so she's having a great time. She's gained back the weight. She's now strong again. She really couldn't walk when she came, and now she can. And she's happy as a clam. So, you know, if it came down to they can't manage her in the home, you know, then the next step would have been to place her. I mean, of course, you have to make sure that you've gotten the DPOA set up for her as well, so you have a decision maker. You know, sometimes if it's not the spouse, it's a family member, or if you have nothing written up and then no one has capacity, you have to get a conservatorship, which is a drag. But
well, and those are other resources. If we're using some, if you're not tracking the DPOA and those powers of attorney and the types of them, check out. We've got a great resources on the website, especially for financial caregivers. We just recently have been working through a series with the Bureau of Consumer Finance to help, and they've got some tremendous materials that are sitting and with FDIC that's on all of our platforms, including in the Facebook Clubhouse. But those are a whole series of those documents to get in line. Good time to get them in, good time to start thinking about it. It gives you options longer term. If nothing else, it'll give you more options or arrows in your quiver to be able to work with, I think, when you're responding to some of these. You know, one thing that I do want to say, because I think a very common hangup that I hear for this is that they, you know, when you're trying to do what mom and dad want to do, or mom or dad, or whomever it might be, Aunt Susie, getting them to want to do something or tell them what that is, where that thing is, getting that out of them is a difficult conversation a lot of times. And this is one you reminded when you were, the way you were talking about, you know, taking stock of your, I don't think you said constraints and limitations. That's what came to my mind, or those things that could impact you, or what did they want to do? It reminded me of what we do in senior move management. When we're working with a family, we start with why. Our initial start for a plan is figuring a why, finding a why. When we have a difficult time getting a family member to move, out of seeing themselves moving out of that situation, one thing that can break that is get them to think of one thing they'd like to accomplish, so that they're not waiting to die in the grief of the current situation or the gravity of the current situation, right? What is one thing, just one thing you want to accomplish? Whether you want to learn to take a picture of this or work from this, and you can start developing a plan around accomplishing that one thing. And sooner than not, you can start being seen not as somebody who's coming to them and telling what to do, but as an enabler of something that they want to do. And starting that small, I'm thinking there's something like that could play in as well. With helping, maybe you're helping another family member who's working in caretaking, finding a goal that they want to do with that. So you can push in and help them as well, or maybe helping mom and dad figure out, what they do want to accomplish, even living with dementia as they're moving forward and not just giving up or packing up or waiting, to die from the disease. How would that reflect? What's your experience?
Well, so for the elder who's having cognitive decline, if it's early, they can tell you. If it's later, they can't tell you, but they'll show you. You know, what do they enjoy doing? You know, I've had families where, you know, dad only used to like to go to the opera, so he's not going to want to play bongos and sing. And dad might be really happy playing bongos and singing and being in a day program because, you know, he's got moderate dementia. So I think it's really important, you know, as a friend of mine, Stephanie Howard, who works with a lot of families, says, you know, first we're going to talk about what does your loved one want, and then what do you want? And you have to always remember that what you want, it's important to acknowledge, but what is really important to focus on and to support is what does the elder want? You know, do they not like doctors? Do they not like to go to the hospital? Don't make them do it. You know, you can be more palliative. You can still give them care, but, you know, if they go to the hospital and get tied down and sedated, what's the point of that? You know, unless they have something like a hip fracture and it's just pain. So you need to make sure that, you know, you allow that sort of situation to be treated, but then, you know, don't follow up on an ultrasound for a carotid, you know, narrowing and that sort of thing. I didn't get to talk very much about treating agitation, but there's a lot on our website, Dr. Liz Geriatrics, and on our Facebook page, Dr. Liz Geriatrics. And we do have the book and also telehealth and telemedicine for folks in California. Please check us out.
Yeah, I love that. And in fact, you know, I think what I'd love to see is we can put together just a good Q&A session with our group. Maybe get you on and have groups really ask those questions, set that up ahead of time. To especially on maybe on a topic that specific into that working with that agitation and some of those other things. I think you just have a wealth of information. I'm so appreciative for you.
Well, I'm available for any groups. I just had, there was an insurance company, you know, of like 500 people and I had like 175 asking me questions and it was great. I mean, that's kind of my goal these days is to help families learn more about what they need. Once you have that structure, it's not overwhelming and scary. It's like, oh, okay, we have to do this and I need to get that. And it becomes manageable. So I appreciate what you do, Tony. I mean, what a gift you're giving.
Oh, thanks be to God that we get the opportunity to do it. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, please, you know, join me please in thanking Dr. Liz Landsberg for joining us today. Please check her out. And if you are one of those families who have come to us and ask about some help for the messy stuff, again, this is definitely one of your next steps. For those of you that are also looking to get to some of those resources, you're going to find them on parentprojects.com. You'll also find some of those resources. I know we're going to take some links to her website. We'll be posting them also in our clubhouse, at the Facebook clubhouse, and you'll find some below in the show links for today. Thanks very much for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you.
God bless you. Well, that's it for the team this week, and thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed the content, remember to subscribe and to share this episode on the app that you're using right now. Your reviews and your comments, they really help us expand our reach as well as our perspective. So if you have time, also drop us a note. Let us know how we're doing. For tips and tools to clarify your parent project, simplify communication with your stakeholders, and verify the professionals that you choose, you can find us on YouTube, follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Thanks again for trusting us. Until our next episode, behold and be held.
Thank you for listening to this Parent Projects podcast production. To access our show notes, resources, or forums, join us on your favorite social media platform or go to parentprojects.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Family Media and Technology Group Incorporated and Parent Projects LLC. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcast.